This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Human accomplishments like successfully climbing the world's highest mountain can inspire us. Now imagine achieving that feat while blind. Former Connecticut resident Eric Weinmayer lost his eyesight in his teens, yet he didn't let that stop him from making it to the top of Everest in 2001. Coming up, we'll talk with Weinmayer, the author of several books, including Touch the Top of the World and his latest, No Barriers. Less than one-third of climbers make it to the top of the world's highest mountain. My next guest has successfully climbed Everest 9 times, making her the woman with the most Everest ascents on record. Lhakpa Sherpa is a native of Nepal. She lives in West Hartford with her children, and she joins me now in studio. Lhakpa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate inviting me here. I'm so happy.
So earlier this year, I understand that you climbed Mount Everest, as I mentioned, for the 9th time. For people who, most of us have heard of Mount Everest, but we're talking about a mountain that's 29,000 feet above sea level. What was that like to reach the ascent the 9th time?
Yes, because I'm so learning my patience in the top of the Everest. I'm born 4,000 meters in very high altitudes in my mom's house. And after I wake up, I'm a baby. My childhood, I just see this mountain around me because I never know have a toys. I never know have a cell phone, anything electrics my life have it. And I see this mountain, my eyes, I open. I love because we are my dad also guiding up in the mountain and many tourists. And I say, I want to follow them. Mm. My dad put this step.
Tell me more about your upbringing in Nepal. So your parents, how many siblings did you have?
I have 7 sisters and 4 brothers. Yeah, and also my both 4 brothers is guiding people. Any Himalayas people come in, tourists comes, they guide service in Nepal.
So I had read that your parents were farmers, but when did your father decide to help climbers make it to the top of Everest?
My dad work hard in my mom's house, mostly mom's housewife. And my dad's one looking jobs, bring food in all the children, and give a good life in the wife. He taught it the best way. And he also, 4 brothers must send school very far away. And we are in Nepal, no school, the girl no can go to school. Anyway, my brothers, very 2 hours walk. And I must carry all the times my back. 2 brothers, one is carry, one is with me walking, and I'm look like a yellow bus in the air. You know, I carry them all the times back and forth in 4 hours. 2 hours back in school, 2 hours back in 4 hours I working. My mom's send me pick up the brother, and I must go. Yes.
It sounds like you were a good sister then.
Yeah, I feel like I'm look like a yellow bus.
You were saying that the reason that your father started helping with these climbing expeditions is to help your family, including your brothers. So when did you first start helping your father in terms of helping the tourists make that climb?
Tourists comes, you know. My dad want to guide up and show them the path, guidings, hiking. And I want to go, you know, look like my dad. And my mom says no. You are the woman. You must stay home and learning the cooking, whatever woman things. You must need the marriage. And I really boring. You know, I say, no, this is not my job. And I don't want it. And all my sister listen, but I'm a little bit not listen. I want to go hiking. So much beautiful hiking hill, you know, this around me. You know why? I want to go explore myself. You know, I don't want to stay housewife. And my mom's very worried for me. I cannot find a man. Because I do the men things. And she said, who married this girl? You know, she never know learns women things.
This is Where We Live. Lhakpa Sherpa is in studio with me. She's a West Hartford resident and the only woman to hold the record of climbing Mount Everest 9 times. Despite her mother's reservations, Sherpa went on to work as a porter when she was 15 years old in Nepal, working alongside her father. She would carry items for tourists from one base camp to the next.
I carry because I'm very tall, look like my dad. All my sisters are very small size, medium size. I'm a little tall, and I can't carry look like a man. jobs, and I carried them heavy things, you know. And my dad says she can carry heavy things, you know, she can go with me. But, you know, yes, my dad tests me, and I can carry heavy things, and I can follow his label, walking. Mm. Yeah. And he take me, he say, yes.
But it was when you were in your 20s, when you were actually able to climb yourself with other women. How did that happen? What did you have to do to get that permission to go?
One woman, Tarai, she had three children, and she died. She summit, but she no make it down, and she died. That time, I'm really teenagers, my age. And I said, well, I know that she died, you know, we see, you know, she died. And every woman is scared, and everybody's, you know, really, a Nepal, a Sherpa woman, Nepali woman, they really not do sport. They just want to stay home, do cooking, and give us the food and husband, and take care of the children. They do. I'm really not wanting this, and I feel I want men jobs. I like learning men jobs. What are men doing, you know? What are women doing? I want to share, you know, my experience. I want to learn how many men work hard, or women work hard. I want to do it, but I want to feel my body. I want to test them, you know, I did. And I'm so scared, you know, I really want to go climbing big mountain, small mountain. I already summit Merak Peaks, Ngawal Peaks, 6,000 meters. I never know been in any school training. I just want to learn myself. Everything's myself. I learn, you know, step by step.
So how did you and this group of women, did you have to petition the Nepalese government to be allowed to climb yourselves, not as a guide, but this is something that you wanted to do?
The men's no belief. Whoa, why women climbing? This woman died, Pasan Lam was die already. Why you want to go? I really want to go, you know, I say. I want to go helping me. I say, I need the help. And I write some letters. And it give everybody's government. I really want to go. Tell, you know, some women accept, you know, some smart, educated woman. His prime minister daughters in Nepal. His name, Sushma Goyal. She's accept them. She said, yeah, she want to go. We help. You know, she did helping me. And all the Nepali women teams. I go. You know, I have a long dreams. In I summit, because I had my mind set up many, many years. I want to summit Mount Everest. I want to show them Nepali women can do it, a sport, but not have educated, but this sport is learning myself. Mm. And I show them the women I can do it. You know, all women, after they really, Lakwa did. And she did again. And she did again. She not die. Everybody excited. And they follow my footsteps, and I'm very happy. Yes.
So this was a goal of yours for a long time. You said that you learned yourself. When we think about when people do different sports, they have to train for it. And Mount Everest, climbing Mount Everest, can be very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So how did you prepare?
Yes, Mount Everest is very dangerous. By luck, you know, sometimes they can kill. Sometimes Mount Everest is we cannot fight, you know. We just go. Some avalanche is coming, we accept them. But I'm lucky. I feel I'm lucky, you know. They're not really. We also, Mount Everest is a god in the mount. Chamulengmo means god in the mothers. We really respect them. All Sherpa women respect in the Mount Everest.
Did you ever have an experience where there was an avalanche or an earthquake where you were concerned about surviving to see another day? Can you talk about that?
Yes, I am so earthquake in Nepal, 2000. Earthquake day, I'm a day in Everest Base Camp. I'm a game one. But all the game, Base Camp people die, and we stay alive. Game one people not die because Game one is more dangerous, but Everest is, best game is no dangerous. But we stay alive when game one people, the game one, two people, best game people all die. I feel so shocked.
This was in 2015?
Yes, 2015. And I feel all the mountains coming my way. You know, I feel I'm seeing in this ice down. I feel I not see my daughters. And I so confused. 5 seconds, right there go, you know. Look like all the mountain falling different direction and noisy. And we are alive. And we come back and that day I know summit, I come back because so many people die and so many Mother Nature happened. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But that didn't keep you from trying again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel I accept the Mother Nature, you know. I going back in the next times, 2016, and I summit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You were able to prove a lot of people wrong, being a woman to climb Mount Everest. You didn't die. You did it again and again and again. What is it about climbing Mount Everest? What does it mean to you to be able to achieve that?
People drinking wine all the times, never no stop. I feel like that now. I feel all the Mount Everest in my body, all the mountains. I need to go. I no go. I feel I'm sick. You know, I feel something hurt me. You know, I need to go because Mount Everest is my doctors making feel good. You know, I had a defacture makes it disappear. I feel look like changing with the ear. You know, it really make me feel good in the Everest. Yes.
I understand you have 3 children. 2 of them are daughters. How do they feel about their mother being the only woman to have summited Mount Everest 9 times? What do they say about you? Are they proud of you?
My daughters is both daughters born in Harper, Connecticut, Harper. I feel I'm a Connecticut woman right now, but my English not so good, but I feel it's a woman here me, you know. I live in almost many years. I've been 2 children born here. My daughter is now is 16. She going Connor. One is she going Cedric's Middle School. She's 11. I'm so happy, you know. I work so hard and give this girl good educators, not look like me, you know, how they need it. I feel I'm hurt myself. I cannot read right, you know, I'm not good to speak English. And I really want these 2 girls have a great educated. I taught them my best. And I think they're doing good too, very good girl. I'm very happy. And I go in Everest. They said, Mama, are you going again? No way, and I'm scared. You die, who watch you, Mama? Who take care of us? And I look my daughter's face. Believe me, trust me, I am come back. I know them, I'm experienced, Mama, learning many, many years. You can touch your computers and laptops, your phone. You had not very comfortable, you know, miss it. I'm going to look like that mountain. I'm very comfortable. I come back. You know, she look in my face, and she say, yes. Promise? Yes, I promise. I come back. You know, of course, I come back again and again. They trust me. It come back me life, yes.
Mm. You mentioned earlier that you were unable to go to school, so you're so very proud of the sacrifices that you've been able to endure so that your children, your daughters now have an education.
Yeah, I work hard, whole food. I also test myself right now, this moment. Men, single men, and single mom, single men, fathers, working 2 both jobs, very difficult. And I feel them. You know, all that I really respect them. All single mom and single dad, is really they do double shift all the times. You know, I did myself. You know, I understand this life now.
Can I ask, Lakpa, what brought you to Connecticut? How long have you lived here?
My ex-husband's, we meet in the mountains. I come from here, we each other no good, and we divorce. And I taken myself, my children, 7 years right now, it's 8 years almost.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Lakpa Sherpa, a West Hartford resident who has climbed Mount Everest 9 times, the only woman to do so. After the break, we're going to continue our conversation, and you can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. My guest today is Lakpa Sherpa, who lives in West Hartford with her children. This past spring, she completed her 9th successful climb of Mount Everest, the world's highest mountain. She's the only woman to hold that record. I asked her how New England's mountains compare to the Himalayas. Sherpa just recently hiked up the White Mountains.
I just summit Mount Washington's 1 month ago. After I coming, I really want to go explore myself, you know. Here in Connecticut, is no had mountains, you know. But here, Connecticut, very near, it's one beautiful mountains that can hike 4 hours. Up 4 hours, come 9 hours, we walk. It's great, you know. Look like it's beautiful round here mountain. And I don't need to go California, Colorado. I opened also Kaloskave climbing. You know, I like take who want to go hike with me. I like helping, you know, teach my experience.
You mentioned Cloudscape climbing, so that's your own company where you take people on hiking and climbing expeditions?
Yes, I like taking hiking and climbing because people want to go, can contact us.
So your day job is you work at Whole Foods as a dishwasher, as you mentioned, but your passion is climbing. That's why you opened up this company?
Yes, yes.
We'll have more information about Cloudscape climbing on our website at WMPR.org/where we live. Now, Lakpa, can I ask you about how Mount Everest has become increasingly popular among tourists who want to climb? Are there any concerns that you have with how, I guess, this industry, for lack of a better word, has exploded in recent years? Because it is dangerous. And we know in 2014 there was that avalanche that killed many Sherpas.
Yes. At this Mount Everest, very good popular because everybody want, who don't want to go, you know, top of the wall, you know, beautiful view and beautiful hike. Everybody likes to go, you know. People sometimes scared, but some people not scared. They say, okay, I want to go. It's a beautiful top of the wall. Why not? You know, Sherpa helping. You know, we are helping very well in tourist people that we really, really, some tourists is the problem. We stay there. Some rescue people call. We still stay with the tourist man. Never not let alone. We watching look like a babysitting, you know, bring very well down. And we put them summit, you know, we bring people happy, go send home. We jobs this, you know, makes people happy.
I understand it's not cheap to climb Mount Everest. I think a group of seven, it costs about $70,000. So definitely a certain population of wealthy people can afford to do this. Are there enough, what I'm asking is with the pressure, with the popularity of climbing Mount Everest, are there enough safety measures to protect Sherpas like yourself?
Yes. They're very smart people climbing Everest, climbing. They're very rich people. And also the very educated people comes. They want to do only one time, and they go home, and it's good. Mm-hmm. They want to dream successfully, happy, what they want.
I mentioned earlier that earlier this year, you climbed Mount Everest for the 9th time successfully. When's the next time that you'll be attempting this? Because you said to us that, you know, it's almost as if the mountain calls you back time and time again. And how long does it take? How much time out of the year does it take to climb Mount Everest?
2 months. The Everest is a season. One season coming one time. 1 year, so one season comes. This season is April and May. After it, they had a very good season because springs very near, you know, we follow the spring up in this. One season is the best area, the April. And I go fly April 10 in Kathmandu, and after I start them climbing up in the mountains. In May 2021, I summit all the times, maybe early. Defend the Everest weather.
I mentioned you have two daughters. One day, do you hope to climb Mount Everest with them?
They had a different dreams. Mm. One girl is a rider's dreams. You know, people, they're changing a lot. They're changing. But now my big daughter, Sunny, she not changing. She still keeps the same dreams. One, I told Sunny, you do something new to come. I asked, no, I want to shame, I want to do it. Mm-hmm. It's good. Mm-hmm. Follow the your dreams, and you reach there. I told like that.
Recently, in the country of Peru, there's a group of women who've been permitted to be porters, so similar to what Sherpas are doing, but carrying the supplies, the tents for people who are making the trek on the Inca Trail. What do you think about that when you hear about other women that are accomplishing these feats?
Very good. We must do it step by step. Hard work. Hard work is work all the time. It's good. I feel women do that, you know, follow dreams, work hard. My dad told me, eat healthy food, work hard, never not die. I do. I remember my dad told me this. You eat healthy food and you work hard, you never not die. This is I believe.
So spring of 2019, will you be attempting to climb Mount Everest for the 10th time?
Yes, I try because I feel in it. 9 times. My dream is the 10th. I feel as have a 10 hands. You know, now I only keep the 9 times. I feel, you know, I have 1 fingers myself. And I feel, I look like I want to finish my school. Look like I feel it's graduation, you know, my jobs. And I feel I'm a 1 of 10 times, yes. Mm. I feel feel like that.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you, Lakpa. You've told your story several times. So what do you want people to get from hearing about your accomplishments? What do you want them to learn?
I want to write book one day, my childhood, what I come from, what I have it. This is I want to do my life. My daughter told me, Mama, nobody writing book for you. I want to write it. Little one say, yeah, I need to write it because I really, really want a book, you know. Everest is one educated part. Sometimes whole put I work, bunch of friends, no understanding Everest. You know, Everest is the one educated learn. Children must learn in bigger mountains, which way. I want to tell them it's a mountain Everest in Nepal between China in Tibet in between Nepal. Half is in Nepal, half in Tibet people's mountain there, Tibet. This is people say Mountain Everest Japan sometimes. They say, oh, Mountain Everest what? What that means? The name, they ask me like that. And I'm really shocked.
So in writing this book, you hope to educate more people about the mountain?
Yeah, maybe children can learn more Himalaya things, you know, children, Everest, which part is it that belong that? Children can learn, yes.
Well, when you have that book written, we'd love to speak with you again, Lakpa.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. This is a long time, so you must wait.
Lakpa Sherpa, again, is a West Hartford resident. She's climbed Mount Everest 9 times, the only woman to do so. She holds the record. And she'll be summiting Mount Everest again next spring. Lakpa, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much and invite me talking radio. I'm so happy. Namaste, my side. Thank you so much.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, Eric Weinmayer joins us. The former Connecticut resident describes himself as a blind adventurer, and he's completed the 7 summits, successfully climbing the highest peaks on the 7 continents. We'll talk with him after the break, and you can join the conversation too. Email us, wherewelive@wmpr.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In 2001, Eric Weinmayer became the first blind person to reach the summit of Mount Everest. It wasn't his first climb, and it certainly wasn't his last. He describes himself as a blind adventurer, and he's written several books, including his latest, No Barriers. I spoke to him recently via Skype about his life, including part of his childhood spent in Connecticut. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Now, I want to learn a little bit of your backstory, and I understand that you grew up part of the time here in Connecticut. But when you were a young child, you were diagnosed with a rare eye disorder. Could you tell us more about that time in your life?
Well, I, kind of vaguely remember it. It was 4 years old. My dad said my eyes were tracking incorrectly, and it sort of alarmed him. So he sent me, we went around to a bunch of doctors, and after dozens of doctor visits and experts, they told me and my family that I would be blind by an early teenager and that there was no cure to this disease. And yeah, I lost a lot of sight over middle school. I'd wake up kind of every couple of days to a new reality as bits and pieces of my retinas would break away. And about a week before my freshman year in high school, I was totally blind. And that was quite a shock, because it's not like I'm a little bit blind, I'm visually impaired. No, I'm blind as a bat. Like, I couldn't take a step in front of me. And that was really scary. That was not the easiest time.
How did your parents prepare you for that outcome? I'm sure that the doctors said, and as you mentioned, that you would eventually lose your sight. And this is also a time where in adolescence, it can be difficult growing up and going through certain emotions, but you were losing your sight. How did that impact you, and how did your parents help you?
I just wanted to fit in. You know, I just did like any middle school kid, you know, you don't want to stand out, you know. So my parents tried to prepare me by trying to make me learn Braille and like get ready using a cane. And I didn't want any part of that, because blindness to me was this evil word. And if I gave into it, then it would make me blind. And so I just fought it tooth and nail. And I did what every kid would probably do, which was I completely ignored it. I denied it. You know, I would make up reasons why I was losing sight, you know, like, oh, I didn't need enough breakfast this morning. You know, just silly things, but your brain is so powerful, you know, it can convince you of whatever it wants to. So I was in absolute denial. There's nothing my parents could do to prepare me, really.
What changed for you where you weren't fighting the blindness anymore?
Well, I mean, partly you get beat into submission, right? Honestly, I was not using my cane properly. I took a step off a dock, and I did a flip in the air, and I landed on my back on the deck of a boat. And the things like that, I thought, okay, you know, this thing is bigger than me. This blindness, I can't beat it. You know, I can't change it. I can't change the reality of it. So I have to kind of give into it. And in a way, that was a good thing, because it sort of pushed my ego back and gave me some humility to say, okay, this is my reality. And I have to, one, begrudgingly accept it and sort of find a place for blindness and not think of it as some evil, devastating thing like cancer that's, you know, going to kill me, but just make it a part of my life and integrate it into my life. And then sort of figure out a way to push the parameters within that box, you know, push the parameters as much as possible. And the way I would do that would be to learn these skills, you know, to learn how to use a cane, to learn how to read Braille, to, you know, to use computers with technology, you know, voice synthesizers. And ultimately that led to me realizing, I guess, that the fun and the adventure of life is finding your pathway. It's not just like fitting in like a sheep, you know, but actually sort of trying to figure out your own individual pathway through the world. And that became quite an adventure.
I understand that you were pretty athletic, and tell us how you established yourself as a wrestler in high school, and then how you started to, as you mentioned, push the parameters, push the boundaries, even being introduced to rock climbing.
I remember sitting on the side in the bleachers on the gym and listening to my brothers, who were great athletes, you know, pound up and down the basketball court, scoring baskets. And my dad was a captain of his football team, and he was a Marine fighter pilot in Vietnam. So we had like a lot of adventure and athletics in our family. And I thought, what am I going to do? You know, I can't play basketball anymore. I just kept getting pounded in the head with the ball. So one, I joined the wrestling team. It was really scary, but I loved it. I tapped my cane up the hallway one afternoon and joined the wrestling team. They beat my face into the mat just like every other wrestler. I loved that. I didn't want to be babied. I found my family. I committed myself to wrestling. I loved being a part of things that were bigger than me, you know, where blindness wasn't the focus. I was just in this family and we were all pursuing something big. I love that. And I got a letter in Braille of a group taking blind kids rock climbing. It was part of a recreational program for blind kids. And I ran my hand up the wall of my room in Connecticut and I said, who would be stupid enough to take a blind kid rock climbing? So I signed up. And I loved it. It was so engaging, you know, feeling my way up the granite rock face, using my hands and my feet as my eyes, sort of problem solving the pattern in the rock and trying to discover what came next. It was so utterly engaging, so opposite of what I thought blindness could ever be, that it was the opposite of that prison that I envisioned blindness being. And I don't know, long story short, 16 years later, I was standing on top of the world. It changed the trajectory of my life.
As a young man, you moved to Arizona and you were teaching at Phoenix Country Day School. And that's when I believe you really started to take climbing seriously. So tell us about the first summit. Is it Denali that you did?
Yeah, well, I was mostly just a weekend warrior rock climbing in the desert. I joined the Arizona Mountaineering Club. And my friend, Sam, he has attention deficit disorder. So he's really like a great thinker because he doesn't think in such a linear way. And we're climbing in the desert, rock faces. And he said, we should try something bigger. And I was like, well, like what? You know, like a bigger rock face? And he said, let's try Denali. And I got really carried away with that idea. You know, I'd barely even been in the snow, you know, except in Boy Scouts. And this is a massive 20,000 foot glaciated peak. And it started a process training for a year and a half. You know, it's one thing to sort of creep along, you know, in your progress, but we actually committed. We said, I'm going to pick a date in June and we're going to do it. And it's a year and a half from now and we got to get ready. So it makes you go from A to Z really fast. And we just went all around the country, just training like crazy, learning how to navigate as a blind person, how to set up tents with my hands, you know, with gloves, and how to cook meals on stoves, and how to pull people out of crevasses, just getting as self-sufficient as I could. And in June 1995, which is a long time ago now, we stood on the summit of Denali after 19 days. It turned out to be Helen Keller's birthday when we stood on top. And at that point I said, okay, this is so unbelievably hard. I don't know if I'm cut out for this life, but I like to devote my life to adventure and see if I could make a life as an adventurer. Kind of a not the easiest path being blind.
You went on to complete the seven summits, so the highest peaks on the seven continents, including Mount Everest. In 2001, you became the first blind person to reach the summit. Could you describe that moment for us again? You became blind in your early teens, but you did this, you know, this feat that many of us couldn't do. What was it like when you reached that summit?
Well, your body physically, you just get beat up every day and then you have to wake up and do it all over again. So you're just slowly plugging your way up the mountain. And we left at 9 o'clock at night. We had a team of 13 Westerners and eight Sherpas. We piled out of the tent like clockwork and we pushed through the night. And, you know, it's just kicking steps, one step after the next. My team out there breaking trail and helping me out, helping me to navigate. And, we were lucky because we didn't have a lot of wind that day. It was snowing on and off and some lightning and storm in the distance, but we were really lucky, fortunate. And I crossed the Hillary Step, and about a half an hour from the summit, I was taking six breaths between each step, which actually is fast on Everest. And I was counting my breaths. And you take a step and there's nowhere else to go. And you're standing on this little island about the size of a single car garage in the sky. And I could, you know, blind people use what's called echolocation. You know, sound is like, it's vibration. It's going off into space and bouncing off of objects and coming back at you. And you get lots of good information through your ears, through those sound vibrations. And on the summit of Everest, I could hear the sound of the sky that literally just moved out infinitely through space. It was the most powerful sound that you could hear, just being swallowed by sky, by space. It was very, very beautiful and kind of scary.
There are some who are probably hearing your story for the first time and are thinking, but if you couldn't see, you know, what was that like at the top of the summit? But you have said to others that, you know, climbing is not a visual sport. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, sight is a really powerful sense, right? It's a very big sense where you get tons of information. But when you go blind, you don't have sight anymore. You have to use your other senses. You have to milk what you have, you know, to get beauty and information from the world through your other senses. So I think it's enough for me, you know, the movement of your body, you know, rhythmically moving up the mountain, plunging your axe into the snow or the ice, feeling the wind, feeling the sun, feeling the texture of the rock and the ice under your hands, sensing that open space around you, as I said earlier. So I think you get plenty of scenery. It's just not the kind of scenery that a sighted person is used to. To be honest with you too, most of the time people summit a mountain and they're in a whiteout, like it's cloudy, big clouds all around you. You can't even see anywhere. So most times sighted people are in the same boat as me anyway.
Can I ask you, late last year, Nepal attempted to ban blind people, also double amputees, from climbing Everest. I believe recently a court overturned that ban. What was your reaction when you heard about these rules that Nepal was trying to put there?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to articulate. And I kind of was like, I didn't want to get myself into trouble by being too aggressive with my opinion. But I honestly think, and maybe this is too blunt, but I think that it comes down to superstition, you know, because Everest was, you know, when it was first climbed by Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, they thought, oh God, these people step foot on the mountain, up high on the mountain, it's going to bring rain, it's going to rain destruction and bad luck and all sorts of bad stuff down on the village. And I think that's the same way that is the superstition around blindness in Nepal and Tibet and places like that, you know, that maybe you've done something bad in a past life to deserve this fate. And so you're cursed with bad luck. And if you go onto the mountain, you're going to bring bad luck on everyone around you and Nepal itself. And so I think the ruling of banning blind people and disabled people from the mountain was based a little bit on that superstition. Funny enough, when I climbed Everest, we were trying to get Sherpas to join our team, and we couldn't find them. They wouldn't join our team because of that bad luck thing. And one of the guys, Anpasang Sherpa, had climbed Everest three times, and he said, "I'll join your team. I don't believe in this idea of that you're born with bad luck. I think you make your own luck. I think you make your own karma." And that was so powerful. And once he joined, all the Sherpas joined, and they were our biggest supporters.
How have you seen your story and what you've been able to accomplish really start to squash misperceptions about blindness? Can you talk about how in certain interviews you've done where you hear people doubt that this can be something that anyone can do, or they want to doubt the fact that you're able to accomplish this despite not having sight? Can you walk us through some of those misperceptions and how you respond to them?
That used to happen when I was younger, you know what I mean? But I don't find that as much anymore. People don't really doubt me personally. You know, like a few years ago, I kayaked the Grand Canyon, and you know, that was bigger in some ways for me than climbing Everest. I could solo kayak the Grand Canyon with guides behind me yelling directions through, you know, massive 20, 30 foot waves. And not too many people said, "That's impossible, you can't do that," you know, because I think maybe in the modern world, people have learned their lesson. I think more importantly, it's about people's perceptions of what's possible for them. Because I think so many of us, we start out with adventure and hope and excitement. And, you know, along that journey of life, we get beat down, we get baggage, we get crust that we build over ourselves. And we kind of get sidelined into this place that we don't want to be. And I hope my story and the message of No Barriers is the idea that you don't have to get sidelined. It's a treacherous road as you progress through your life. But yet, if you can kind of commit to these elements, these ideas of what growth, of how to grow and evolve through your life, then you can keep moving forward. You can keep breaking through your own personal barriers, and you can contribute to the world in some profound way. So I think for me, the response is more of a personal thing when I meet people who have been beat down by anxiety or fear or post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma, these invisible barriers that just get in our way. To me, that is a profound connection to say to those people, look, you can move forward with the right credibility, you know, with a little more credibility.
This is Where We Live. I'm speaking with Eric Weinmayer. He's a blind adventure author and speaker, used to live in Connecticut. He's joining us today via Skype. Eric, you referenced your most recent book, No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. So after doing the seven summits, you've pushed yourself to a new challenge. Tell us about why kayaking.
Well, I was actually up on a big ice face in Nepal, shivering and hungry with a friend. And he said, "Wow, you know what? We should be on a beautiful river in the sun." He goes, "It's way better than shivering and being hungry way up high here." And I laughed. It was a joke, you know, because you're always, when you're climbing, you're thinking about sea level and sunny pursuits. And anyway, so we got back down. I said, "Hey, teach me a kayak roll." And he did. And then I said, "Hey, why don't you, would you guide me down an easy river?" And one thing led to the next. And by, you know, a couple of years out, I'd committed to the Grand Canyon and trying to decipher how we're going to, like, you know, break through these huge rapids. We ultimately came across these amazing radios that my team could communicate with me in really loud rapids. And I kept pursuing this thing, even though it was so different from climbing. You know, rivers are so different. You're moving at the river's pace, right? You're not able to stop like you are on a mountain and reassess and regroup. You can't put on the brakes, you know, and you got to commit. You got to paddle into these massive rapids, and you know, for the next 2 minutes, you're about to get destroyed by these rapids, these waves hitting you in every direction that you can't see them coming at you. And it was hard on my psyche, I have to admit. It was definitely upping the ante in terms of adventure.
When people hear your story, do they see you as a daredevil?
Sometimes people do, but I honestly, and I mean this totally honestly, I'm not a daredevil. I'm a chicken. You know, I'm very methodical about things. I build a great team around me. I build great technologies and innovations around me. I train as hard as a human can possibly train so that I'm prepared. You know, I have that 10,000 hours under my belt, you know, so that I'm prepared for different situations, for improvising on the spot, which is what you have to do often. So I really think I'm enamored by this process of going through, you know, looking at something really big and then figuring out how do you get there? What's the sort of linear map that you build to get from point A to point Z? And even though there's so many things that can shove you to the sidelines along the way, how do you sort of keep moving forward? I think I'm really enamored by that process. And for me, you mentioned the new book. The book is about kayaking, but the book really, the message is much more about this process, which I call No Barriers, which has become a movement now, which is how do you keep moving forward despite the barriers and the challenges that sometimes seem so overwhelming?
Your nonprofit is called No Barriers, and I do want to learn a little bit more about that. But for those of us who haven't kayaked the Grand Canyon, the idea of sometimes being immersed in water, fast water, raging rapids, how did you use that technology when we know technology has limits, and the importance of, again, working with a team to get it done?
Well, the biggest technology was the radio system, because we were looking for radios that I could hear in these massive, loud rapids. And you know, a lot of them had delays. You know, they have a half a second delay, which is an eternity in a rapid. And a lot of them were really unreliable. And so, yeah, finding the right technology, even when we found it, you know, these radios that communicated in real time, they broke down. You know, the Colorado has massive silt, and it gets into the membrane of the radio. And say they even didn't work out. So technology will let you down quite often. So it comes down to your team. My friends just getting behind me, kind of close as they could safely, knowing that you're in this rapid that's could, you know, take you out at any time. And then just yelling very simple, very direct commands like hard left, hard right, small left, small right, charge, which means charge into this hole or this rapid that, you know, if you don't charge hard, it's going to beat you down and it's going to hold you under. So you got to charge through it. So just very simple commands. And then me being a good enough kayaker that, you know, when I get knocked over, which is inevitable, I can roll up. I know the timing of when to roll up when the river releases you.
Again, you mentioned your nonprofit, No Barriers. So tell me how you translate the achievements that you've accomplished throughout your life, these adventures that you've taken on and been able to accomplish. When you talk with children, with veterans, what's your message to them?
Well, for me personally, you know, I think about the mountains, the rivers that I've kayaked, and I think, you know, for me, there's a important piece, which is you're not really just standing on top pounding your chest, although maybe I did that a bit when I was younger. But I think as you get a little bit older and wiser, you realize that the sort of the meaning of these things is to figure out a way to take these gifts, these things that you've been given, these things you've maybe earned through your struggle, and bring them down the mountain and use them in your life and marry that extreme with your everyday life and the people that you interact with. And so No Barriers became a movement to help all of us with challenges. As I said, not just people with physical challenges, but people with invisible barriers, which is all of us in this big No Barriers club, to figure out how do we break through the barriers in our lives that seem so real, that are so big, and how do you, how do you then elevate the world around you through your own experiences? And so, yeah, it became a small movement, and it's been growing ever since. Now we impact about 10,000 people a year, and we had events and programs and expeditions all around the world, and it's been so powerful for me to connect with people. You know, their Everest is just like, I want to walk down a set of stairs again. I want to get out of my house and walk in the sunshine and without fear. I want to get a job again. I want to write a book. I want to climb mountains. I want to start a nonprofit. It's been so fun to be able to facilitate people's own dreams.
It's natural for us at times to doubt ourselves, and it's sometimes hard to block out people's criticisms. But when you hear that from some of the people that you're working with, what is your advice to them? How do they do that?
Well, I think they surround themselves with people that have this no barriers mindset and spirit. So like we hold events all around the country, one of which is coming up in New York in October, New York City, we're holding a big event. But it's surrounding yourself with this community. And, you know, you sit at a table and there's a kid who's blind, who hasn't been off the pavement, who's about to go on a big hike, and a soldier who struggled with some trauma, some PTSD. There's a, you know, woman who's had a full heart transplant and is there living today, and a person who's had trauma and is struggling to work their way through that. And a CEO that's, you know, thinking, I want to bring her business, you know, to the next level. You know, it's just this really eclectic movement. And you surround yourself with people like that, all striving to break through barriers and find purpose in our lives. And it's exactly what every person needs, I think, because we can't do it alone. None of the things I've ever done have been just me. They've been a great team that's lifting you up, that's sort of forcing you to become the best version of yourself.
Your No Barrier Summit, again, is happening in the fall in New York City. We're going to have more information on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. Eric, I can't let you go without asking you about your next adventure. Can you tell us about it?
I'm still climbing a lot. I'm going to head to an amazing, gigantic rock, these rock faces in the desert in December, a place called Wadi Rum, and heading back to the Himalayas to climb a peak called Amada Blam, which I failed at 18 years ago. So really good logic in my life. I failed when I was young and strong. And now as I turn 50, I think I'm going to have a chance. But I really do have a chance because I have experience now. So yeah, we'll try Amada Blam again. And yeah, there's more adventures left in my life than I have cartilage in my knees. So I'll run out of cartilage before I run out of adventures. Those will, you know, I hope to climb for a long time.
Eric Weinmayer, again, is a blind adventurer, author, and speaker. He joined us today via Skype. His latest book, No Barriers, A Blind Man's Journey to Kayak the Grand Canyon. Eric, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Today's show produced by senior producer Lydia Brown. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Our digital producer is Carlos Mejia. You can check out wmpr.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.